Our extra special guest this evening, Nataki Garrett, is the Oregon Shakespeare Festival's sixth artistic director. Prior to her appointment in 2019, she served as acting artistic director for Denver Center for the Performing Arts and was also associate artistic director of the California Institute of the Arts Center for New Performance, as well as interim dean of the Cal Arts School of Theater and co-head of the undergraduate acting faculty. She has been hailed as a champion of new work, as well as an experienced, savvy arts administrator. That's a very good skill to have. As a sought-after freelance director, she has directed world and regional premieres across the country. Her work has been seen at Dallas Theater Company, Woolly Mammoth, Ford's Theater in Washington, D.C., Steppenwolf Theater Company, the Pasadena Playhouse, Mixed Blood Theater Company, and the Matrix Theater Company in L.A., among many others. Christina Anderson's How to Catch Creation was Nataki's OSF directorial debut in 2019. And she will direct the world premiere of Dominique Marceau's Confederates in the 2020 season. Nataki serves on the board of directors of Theater Communications Group, as well as the nominating committee of the Harold and Mimi Steinberg Charitable Trust. She holds a BFA degree from Virginia Union University and an MFA from Cal Arts. Please join me in welcoming Jeffrey and Nataki.
That list of credits is so tremendous. The first question is an easy one. Is it safe to say you love what you do?
I do. I really do love what I do. I've been in love with the theater since I was 13 years old.
I was going to ask for the origin story. What was the original spark?
Oh, the original spark was actually going to see Swan Lake. I was 4 years old. We went to the Kennedy Center. We lived in D.C., which is where I was born, my mother and I. And my mother, this was a... just after she got her graduate degree in early childhood education. So she was coming off of that kind of means. She bought tickets so far in the back. We were basically on the other side of the Potomac. And she said that the whole row, you know, those are hard-working people who scraped together what it meant to get into those seats up there in the Kennedy Center, and they were not happy to see a four-year-old. And I spent the entire time leaned forward, like basically like sideways, hanging over, trying to watch the little things twirling. And I still have a real memory of watching the beings twirling around. And then, you know, of course, we walked out of there, and the next morning I was like, I want to be a ballerina. And somehow my mother scraped together what was necessary in order for me to take ballet class, because within a week, that's what I was doing, and that's my point of entry.
Did you broke a ceiling here, didn't you? You remarked not even 2 years ago that there were no theaters above a $5 million budget with a black woman leader.
That's true. And actually, there are only now two black women leaders of theaters of kind of prominence. Prior to that, the last black female leader was Deborah L. Wicks, and she was in her position for 6 months, and then her board decided to get rid of the charter for that organization and literally started a new one in order to move on beyond her. She's the first African-American woman to run a Lort Theater, and so Hana Sharif is the second and I'm the third.
So you said in an earlier interview you want other women, other people of color to use you as a ladder to a future in the theater. Are enough people in positions of responsibility in the theater world helping that happen?
I think so. I mean, I'm a ladder, but also I climb a few people to get here. I come through Kenny Leon. I come through, you know, my mentor Travis Preston. You don't have to be a woman of color to be a leader. You can just decide that you're going to create opportunities for people, and then actually do the action around it, which is not just to speak about making opportunities, but actually do what it takes to make sure that you have room at your table for as many voices as possible. And so I actually follow an example of mentorship and leadership. I don't create it. I just get to participate in it. I'm one of these people that, I came into this art. The first lesson you learn is that theater is always dying. And so I feel like I have this sort of desperation in me to make sure that it's not. And because of that, I feel like I'm just always trying to create as much path ahead of us as possible, so that if I don't get down there, which is fine, I don't need to be all the way at the end of the path if it ever ends. But I certainly want like 25, 50 years, 85, 100 years, 150 years out to know that there's a path. I need more people. I need to know that there's a way for people to get there. And I'm actually really blessed to be one of the gatekeepers, you know, because I'm going to hold that gate open as wide as I can for as long as I can for as many people to come through.
In your work as a director, review after review, read about how well the actors are directed by you. What are the keys? What are the things to inspire other people to put out their best work?
I respect them and I listen to them. You know, I sat through so many rehearsals with so many mentors that people move actors and puppet actors. And it's excruciating to watch because acting is an artistry, you know. You come with your heart and your intellect and your training and whatever that energy is that makes you an artist, like you come with all those things and you run up against a director who says, great, now could you take all that stuff and leave it on the other side of the door and then just come do what I say? And watching an actor execute the do what I say is terrible, because it's just the director's hand. Here, I'm just gonna puppet you and watch you do this. And so you're watching that, you know, like, what's the Addams Family? You're like watching that hand scurry around the stage. The first time I tried it, because of course you have to be like, one day I'm gonna be a director and everybody's gonna do what I say. And I was like, do it. And then they were like, sure, we'll do it. We don't believe in it, but we're gonna totally do what you say, right? And there's my hand, my ugly, stinking hand on stage. And I was like, from that point forward, never again. I never wanna see my hand. So I'm usually, what I'm doing as a director is getting away from my own hand. Like, what do you want to do? Are you interested? What is your idea? You know, here's my idea. Take my idea. I'm going to give it to you. And I know I'm going to, if I turn around in a full circle, when I come back around, you will have exploded my idea into something I could never have imagined on my own. That's why you're here too. You know, that's what I do. Thanks.
From now on, I'm going to see Thing from the Addams Family.
Yeah, scurrying around up there.
You are able to think and talk about the art of theater, but also things like revenue. I mean, do the sides of your brain take turns, or is all the processing going on all the time?
I'm a part of a generation of arts leader that was undeniably trained that you had to have both heads at the same time. We all come up under those auteur directors who sort of, you know, like the Disney was the Walt was the heart and the ideas, and Roy was the brains, you know. And who can afford that life anymore, you know, where you can just sit around and let somebody else brain things for you, you know. But I think the other thing is that I have always been somebody who wanted to know how things actually work. You know, my directing style tends to be a little bit deconstructive. I turn the idea sideways and I dump it over. I take all the pieces apart. And so I want to know, like, how it's made. I'm the kind of director that a producer can say, well, that's a really amazing idea, Nataki. Here's $12.13 to do it. And I'll be like, really? Let's try. You know, so I'm always trying to consider the prism of possibilities. And I think that's why I'm administratively minded. Plus, my mom's a teacher, and my dad, and several aunts and cousins. And so I just come from this space. My dad was an organizer during the civil rights movement. My mother built a school with her hands and taught people in it. And so I come from this space of organizing. I sort of get it. I'm an administrator naturally. My mother was a principal. That's the career she retired from. And watching her lead her sometimes younger teachers, sometimes older teachers, through these moments of having to implement these strategies that came from people who knew nothing about education, and working really creatively with the group of people around her, and really trying to make sure that they knew where the horizon line was, and really understanding without really knowing, like her raw talented ability to understand how the business was run. And I just think I paid a lot of really close attention to that.
There's still a lot of educator in you then, I'm thinking. I mean, not just with the people you work with on stage in the immediate vicinity, but also the audiences that come to see the shows.
Yeah, somebody just asked me that question recently. If do I miss it? Is it still a part of my life? And I think it was there before I even started teaching. I said that I didn't want to be a teacher. I was really clear, because everybody in my life is a teacher. And so I know all the pitfalls and all the terrible parts about being a teacher. And I was like, who wants that life? You know, I'm never going to do that. And here's how I'm lucky. Whenever I say never, I'm probably doing that next. So a couple of months after I graduated from CalArts, I was asked to teach. And I was like, what? You're crazy. I'm not a teacher. yes, you are. And we'd like you to come on this year. And I was starving. So I was like, sure, I'll take this teaching job. Oh, my God. Life changing. Especially because I got to work with young artists. And so there's this really delicate moment where you're watching the young artist come to light, like right before the budding of a rose, like right before it opens, you know, like that moment. And you get to see it. You can't watch a rose do that, right? But you can see it in an actor or an artist's body. You get to watch this, and it's so fragile, right? And you can break people, you know? So you have to be really careful. You have to lead people and push them and also, you know, give them 400 years of lessons, you know, that are passed down generationally. You have to do all of that at once while that thing is coming open. And boy, when that thing pops, my heart. And I got to see it for 10 years of like, whoa, look at you. Once they do that, it's like, you know, that was never yours. I didn't do anything. I just got to be there and help nurture that one little thing. Once they do that, you know, I can't go back and be like, oh, you know, so-and-so is my student. You know, that's not what that is. I was lucky enough to witness it, and it changed me as an artist. It gave me the kind of depth that was necessary. So when I'm going to ask you to do something, I'm going to push you off that cliff, and I'm not going to give you a net. I better know what's happening to you. And teaching gave me that skill to be able to go, okay, first they're gonna be looking at me as they fall over like, what did you do? You know, that moment in the movie, right, like that. And I'm gonna have to be looking at them like, I got you, I'm with you. You're not gonna die, we're gonna do this together. I got that from teaching. I got that from teaching.
I have a few questions about the upcoming season of the Oregon Shakespeare Festival, but I want to ask in general terms first about the mix of forces that lead to setting up a season, you know, the various things you have to consider when planning which plays will go on stage.
Yeah, so I got lucky. Bill and his team of his amazing team that I got to inherit, they selected this season. And I was told by somebody who's a force in my life, if they select that season for you, you better take that, because that's how you're going to learn about the organization, including the patrons who like to go see that art, the people, the community that actually creates that art, the way you raise money for that art. You better learn through that first season, because you're only going to get that one time to learn that way. OSF has this thing called the Boar's Head Process, where a group of company members sit around for weeks and read a curated list of plays. I augmented that just a little bit because I wanted the company as a whole to be participating in it. And even though you can only have a conversation with that small group of people, I allowed people across the company to submit ideas for plays. The only thing you had to do was write something or have your friend write something if you don't feel like you're the kind of writer that lets us know why you're putting this play forward. And then we just read plays, and the difference too is that I made sure that as we were going through the selection process, we didn't start selecting plays. We started just by having conversations about writers and plays, you know, and what jazzed us about this play, and you know, what hit us funny about that play, and why we didn't feel that was quite right for us as the audience. So using the Boar's Head process to listen to an audience of people experience what it means to read Titus Andronicus for the first time, or with a group of people, or read it out loud even. They had a few moments like that. And then we go from that process to sort of taking it through, and I'm hyper collaborative, so I was raised on those kinds of artistic leaders that were like, I'm gonna go into my closet of ideas and then I'm gonna come out with this genius list and then you're all gonna clap because I'm a genius in my closet. Instead, I'm a little bit more like, let's formulate a possible list of things that we might want to be doing next year, and then talk a little bit more about why that is. And then I want to hear from marketing, you know, like, what if we do this play and not this play? What if this play instead of that play? What if we do this play and we let this play pay for that play? I want to hear from finance. I want to hear from my production team. We can't afford it this year. We probably can never afford that play. You're not ever doing that play. Right? And I'm, of course, if you say no to me, I'm like, yeah, sure, we're never doing it. And then I'm dreaming of how we're going to do it. I need to hear from my constituency, from everybody who has a stake in the play, you know, what it means to do it. And then we start to look at the season, like, you know, what goes in what room, what works in rotating repertory. What conversation can this play have with this play? One of the things I really, you can only get here that is very special to OSF is I walk out of Manhattan and I cross the street and I go see Oklahoma. So I have a play about this kind of original sin, which is what it meant to take over this land from people who lived here. And then I have this play about manifest destiny. And then I have to go home and deal with, and then I got to see Mahatta in that same year. And so then I got to deal with like these three plays talking to each other about what it means to have to come here. Like where you don't have a choice to run from persecution, right? And now all of those things, so I have to think about that as I'm developing a season, like how are the plays talking to each other and how are you going to experience seeing five or seven plays at once? So all of that, and right now we're in the process of looking at the 2021 season. Right now we're in that part of it. Marketing is talking to me about what's gonna work, finance is having their conversation about what we can afford. My artistic team is saying, you know, from our shops, like this is our point of view. We have about 15 plays. I don't have to do every play this year. I don't have a temper tantrum when you say no, but I am going to start thinking about how I can get to yes. It doesn't have to happen this year.
So marketing, finance, artistic, all those considerations, you have a bunch of boxes you have to check. It is a Shakespeare festival. You're expected to do some Shakespeare.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And some Shakespeare adjacent I see in this year's. But how much of what goes on outside the festival do you want to make sure you're incorporating too, to take in the events of the day and try to get those reflected in the works on stage?
Well, that comes out of the Boar's Head conversation, because if you allow people to speak as if they are the audience, then they're coming at you from their breakfast table, and they're, you know, when they watch the news this morning, or whether or not they listen to NPR, or, you know, whether or not they're on Facebook, and, you know, and all of that becomes a part of that conversation. So it's from the beginning, if you're from marketing, the last thing I want to hear in the Boar's Head process is it from a marketing point of view, because you weren't born into marketing. Right? That's your job. So what I want to hear is like who you are and how this art affects you. And that took a little bit of undoing because, before the Boar's Head process was a little bit about like your job. I know what your job is. So like if I really needed your job here, I wouldn't ask you to be in the room. I would just ask your job to show up. What I really need is you and your point of view. You know, I need development to say, we probably can find some donors for that. But I actually do need my development folks to say, that play really moved me. And for me personally, it's necessary to experience that play through our company. You know?
So let's look at the list. Angus Bomer Theater has Midsummer Night's Dream, Peter and the Star Catcher, The Copper Children, and Poor Yellow Rednecks. The Thomas Theater has Bring Down the House, Confederates, and Everything That Never Happened. The Elizabethan Theater will have The Tempest, Black Odyssey, and Bernhardt Hamlet. So there are really two pure Shakespeare plays, Midsummer Night's Dream and The Tempest, and then three others that I call Shakespeare adjacent.
Yeah.
Let's talk about Bring Down the House, because this is an interesting reworking of Henry VI.
It's not, it's actually Shakespeare. It's every word they speak is Shakespeare's text. We gave the adaptive credit to Rosa Joshi and Kate Winooski because of the work that they had done as a company putting together this two-part version of all three Henry VI's. It's normal to do the Henry VI's in two parts. It's a lot of theaters do that. I think the last time we did it here, that's how it was done. I think the parts that are not what we've seen here is that it's an all-female cast. And you know better than I do that company. So the first read, and I didn't get to go to it because I was at home sick in bed. So my team calls me up and they're like, Nataki, you have to hear, you know, Vilma Silva's Margaret is crazy good, right? So I'm just, you know, the house is vibrating with what these women are going to offer these roles. So it's not adjacent, it actually is Henry VI. Parts 1, 2, and 3 in two parts, and every word they speak is the Shakespeare text. We just credited it because you have these two women who worked really, really, really hard with their own company to create that, and we felt it was disingenuous not to include the adaptive credit. We all know Shakespeare wrote the plays, but what people don't always understand is that it's actually very rare to have the ability to adapt. And if Ivar van Hoven, who nobody cares how many times he puts his name across the crucible, right, if he can do that, then these powerhouse women who are really doing this without the force of the British Empire behind them, they're doing it. So I'm giving them credit.
I stand humbly corrected. Everything That Never Happened, though, this really is sort of a fill in the gaps, though, between Shakespeare and some other stuff.
Yes, what it is from a Jewish woman's perspective, you have this play that's it's actually, the play is adjacent to the Jewish experience in Spain during that time. No, Milan, sorry, Italy. It's adjacent to that. So if you think about what Shakespeare was really doing, what he was saying is, I wonder if these people live like this. But he didn't actually know, right? And so there are a lot of missteps in that play. There's a reason why we have stereotypes as terrible as are directly related to what's in that play, right? And those stereotypes kill people. And they have, historically. We all know that, right? So I'm not speaking out of turn there. What she does is she says, what if I were to bring to life the moments that we don't get to see? So the negative space around the ideas and the caricatures and the sort of affect of what it means to be Jewish at that time. As a Jewish woman, she had to go in and excavate what the truth might be about people's experience from her point of view. So it relies on the fact that this audience in particular will know what that other play was. and will be able to relate to the need to engage in this conversation. But in particular for our Jewish audience members, will understand why it's so important to excavate for yourself what it really means to be represented in those ways without dealing with the total complexity about what the life is. And that's Sarah Mantel is, I mean, it's, I'm, you know, I do plays for a living, so I'm not always moved in the first read. But this play just floored me because I had to come to grips with the fact that there were things that I had even taken for granted and swallowed whole and said, oh yeah, that's, you know, maybe that is a little bit of truth, you know, because in the middle of a caricature is a little bit of truth that has been exploited and weaponized and used against an entire group of people. And that's what she does, is she's like, oh, well, I just want to reclaim the weapon a little bit, see if I can figure out what the truth is, because I can't sit with this play in the world without engaging with it.
I want to ask about one other play, which is the one that you're directing, Confederates, which is part of the American Revolution cycle, co-commissioned with Penumbra Theater, April 8th through October 31st, two women of color 150 years apart.
Yep. So I had this conversation with Dominic Morceau, and if you ever have an opportunity to talk to Dominic Morceau, you will never walk away without, like, I was Googling that night. I'm in my history books, you know, after having this conversation with her. The well runs really, really deep. It's like an ocean under there. She says, well, the first thing she did was look up this idea of what a confederate is. It's to bring somebody into a league and to make them your accomplice. Whoa, never thought of that when you think of the word Confederate, because we all have this idea, if you know anything about American history, you know what that is. So what does it mean to bring somebody to be an accomplice with you, especially on a task like overturning a government, you know, which is what happened here. So the play is inspired by reading the Ta-Nehisi Coates, I can't think of the title of this essay, but it's where he's talking about why black people don't hold the Civil War as a part of our story, because all the ways in which that story has been co-opted and turned over. And, you know, of course, she was like, well, not only do I want to know that, but I also want to know what it means to be active in rebellion, to be active in your own liberation. And then what it means to be doing that now, because we can look back at that time and be like, oh yeah, Harriet Tubman, Sojourner Truth, like that represents all the women who did that. But she's saying, what if you were like some random woman who worked on this plantation, but you had all of this ability in you that nobody tapped? And what if you're some random woman who works in a university and you're still maligned in the same ways and you have all of this potential in you to untap? You know, and what are the ways in which society dictates your ability to be able to evolve and utilize all of those skill sets? And so she's looking at these two women through that lens. So the two women, and then you have these three characters that move from one time and seamlessly into the other time. So they're moving back and forth. And this idea of who can they be confederated with, and who can they be accomplished with, and what happens to these black women as they're moving from one place to the other. And she's very clear that the play is really trying to excavate a kind of special racism that is reserved for black women in particular, because you have the woman part where you're like, hold your place and keep your mouth shut and don't take up too much room. And then you also have the black part, which is like, really super do all those things. And also remember that you're not supposed to be here in the first place. So, you know, we disinvite you every single time we walk up to you. And she's saying, what does it mean to actually then still be in those spaces where you've been disinvited from and thrive and evolve or try to, you know, and what are the forces that are pushing against it?
So we're having this conversation just 3 days after your keynote at the Martin Luther King Jr. Celebration on Monday. and forgive me for using your own words here, I've been thinking about the future of this country and whether or not the country as we know it will survive and evolve so that the babies of today grow up with freedoms I long to experience. I think about the future of the American theater and if it will still be relevant and to whom and why. I think about the future because I am driven by the mandate that I must be active in making sure there is one. That is what is expected of me. So what tops the list then in maintaining the relevance of theater in that context?
I think you have to speak to another generation. I think, okay, so for maybe about the last 50, 60 years or so, the American theater has done a very good job of convincing one generation that they are at the center. And everything that the theater has done has maintained that. Including how you enter a space, what you do in that space, whether or not you're allowed to participate in what's happening in front of you in the way that you normally would, or do you have to participate like those people do? So we've othered anybody who's not within that. So right now we're going through, in the United States, a decentering of that generation at the same time. Where a lot of our institutions are learning that if we do not invite everybody else into those same spaces, they will not exist at all. So people are moving to their camps. Well, some people become really super selfish and they go, well, I only want this for me anyway, and I don't care what you have to do in order to, you know, I was told once at one of my theaters, all you're doing is pandering to the young. And I was like, duh, yeah. Because just to be honest, you know, in 20 years, I may not even be here, right? So who's gonna be here instead of me? And how do I get out of the way so that I can get them here now so that in 20 years they want to come back here, right? So one of the things I think is really important about creating relevancy is legitimizing cross-generational. And that's tough, you know? Because here's the thing, you can sit at your Thanksgiving table and relate, maybe. I don't know, I'm not at everybody's house. I don't know what that's like with your family. But it's harder in a theater. Because why? Because your hearts are involved. So it's hard to sit next to somebody and share that armrest with somebody as you're being moved, watching the thing that you're watching, and not know if you're gonna be held, because if you look over there, they don't look anything like you. You don't know if they've had your life, right? So people get really antsy in a theater around the space around them and who's there. I've had people be assaulted in my theaters, you know, because it's, you know, like your instinct, shut up, you know, you're ruining my experience. Oh, okay. Now you've ruined mine. And guess what? I got all kinds of other things I could be doing with this time.
Which raises a major question, though. Mm-hmm. I mean, how much of what theater needs to do is about content? How much of it is about comfort? I can stay on my couch. They're putting recliners in movie theaters now with heated seats and everything.
Yeah, and that's great, right? Because sometimes you do want to go into a movie theater and watch it like that. But I think theaters are different because they were built to be collective spaces, to have shared experiences with strangers in the dark, right? They were built on that premise. And the American theater has done a lot to shift that for us, so it doesn't feel like that. I'm in my space, watching my thing. You know, none of the heads are in my way. You go to the theater in Europe, like that person sitting in front of you, you can smell their lunch. They're so close to you, right? And I was in a Broadway house, and we were like on an airplane together, you know, watching Hadestown, and the room is jumping, everybody's excited, and elbows are everywhere, and the guy lifts his cup to drink his wine, and I was like, oh, that's right, I have wine too, thank you, you know? We're all having this collective experience, but you go to most regional theaters, and it is not a collective experience. And that's what I want to create, because when I watch, when I'm in rooms, and I spend a lot of time watching the people in a room, in a theater, and that's movie theaters, my husband can tell you, like, it doesn't matter what room I'm in, I'm leaned forward trying to see what everybody's experience is like that. The moments when cross-generational and diversity, and no matter how you claim your gender, whatever it is, those moments when the room is rolling together, those are the best moments, where you're like, you know, leaning forward in Cambodian rock band going like, oh my God, to rock music, we're all jamming, but also like, you know, but really moved, and it's terrible what we're watching, and you know, and you can do that in a theater. We just have to go back to that in a way. You know, we have to remember that the room was there, was even built for the collective experience and not for the individual experience, because you can have that at home and you can have it in a movie theater in your little separate recliner where you can't even touch your friend, you know, like, you know, you're locked in like a amusement park ride. You know, that's not what the theater is for. The theater is for something different. It's so that you cough and then you cough and then, oh, I have to clear my throat. That's what happens in a theater. It's a collective experience, and I am hell-bent on creating that experience.
I honestly forget where I picked up this quote. It was another interview somebody had done with you about there's going to be a convergence of Black Lives Matter, the Me Too movement, and Time's Up, and you added that the boards have to be ready to listen to the next generation. Has it happened yet?
We're here.
We're here? Where it's happening?
I mean, not to single out as young people, but those of you who are students in this room, would you say that we're here?
Yeah,
we're here. We're already here because that generation is voting this year. You understand? So we're already here. The convergence already happened. That was 5 years back. Right, so we have to actually catch up and get in front of what it means to have to hold the power of a generation that is saying, time's up and we gotta do it together, and we see ourselves as intersectional, and by the way, these are my pronouns, right? All those things are happening right now. If we want our, so in this room with me are a number of people who generously donate to the theater. Generously, every year. Why are you doing it? Because if you're doing it for now, it now is already, like, now already passed. It passed the moment I said the word now. You gotta be doing it for later, because what's coming, that force of this next generation, that force, if we can harness that and get in that with them, I'm ready to, I want that generation to lead. I wanna work for y'all. You know, that's what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to get behind you and that energy. And I wanna create a space where, take it over. And do the thing that you came here to do. Take it over from me. I just want to lay a foundation for that, because I know it's coming anyway, whether we like it or not. It's already here. It's here. And thank God it's here, because a lot of you fought really hard for it to get here. A lot of you did. A lot of you, like, went through it. A lot of you women know what I'm talking about. You went through it so that... There's a whole generation of people who don't know what it's like. It's not normal to be ogled in the way that some of us were. Like, that stuff is, you know, we were here. Me Too is now. So let's do something with it. Let's harness it, get into it, sit next to it, and use the energy, and know that that's the legacy that we leave behind us. Because without that, you know, it doesn't matter relevancy. You know, we're already irrelevant if we're not willing to do it.
You also mentioned in your Martin Luther King Day speech this week that some folks are allergic to social justice. It's a great line, but great observation. Can theater be that hypoallergenic? I mean, can?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think so. I mean, I think it all. I mean, if you read Shakespeare's history plays, at the base of all those plays is social justice. At every single one of those tragedies. That's social justice of his time. Everything is a comment. The comedies, that's social justice, right? So that's actually the avenue of the theater. Yeah, we tricked you. You thought it was entertainment, right? How many of you all go see in whatever other theater you might go see this? I think they do this here, A Christmas Carol. How many of you see A Christmas Carol? That guy's a socialist. Whew, and he isn't he? I saw actually this kind of proletariat-focused version of it, and I was like, yeah, that's right. I forgot you were a socialist. I actually forgot. I was like, you know, Merry Christmas to all, or whatever that last line is Tiny Tim says, or whatever. I forgot that what he was saying is it okay for you that you step over people in the street who are starving? Are you sure? because you're going to have literal hell to pay. And I'm going to show you three different types so that you remember, right? I mean, that's social justice. So plays, that's the role of the theater has always been in that space to engage with those ideas. South Pacific, social justice, right? Doesn't get it right all the way, but it is the beginning of it, right? Even Oklahoma, that's what they're trying to do. They're trying to say, these things have to change, and here's a song. Don't you love it? You know, by the way, shift this, please. Yeah.
I want to ask about one more project before I turn it over to the audience for your questions, and it's about the Carolyn Bryant project that you co-wrote and produced at Blank the Dog. This is really the Emmett Till story inverted. Tell the folks about that.
So we did this at Red Cat, which is the Roy and Edna Disney CalArts Theater, the professional theater that belongs to CalArts that's inside of Walt Disney Hall in LA. And me and my friends, my Confederates, have been working on that play for a number of years. And it came because it was like right as the potential for the first black president showed up, the first black male president showed up on the scene, where we were kind of looking at the possibility of Obama and the primaries. And she was from one of my really good friends, who's also playing Carolyn Bryant in it. She read this article in the Times-Picayune, the New Orleans-based newspaper, and it was about how Carolyn Bryant was being indicted as an accessory to Emmett Till's murder, finally, after all those years. And she brought it to my attention, and I don't know, we were, you know, hanging out at my apartment, drinking a little bit of wine, thinking, I wonder what it's like, you know, what is that like now for her, you know, at this, we do know that the Emmett Till murder is one of those transformative moments that reinvigorated the civil rights movement, right? So in some ways, that moment, that exchange that only took 5 seconds to get through, is this thing that sort of ignites something else. And so you have to live in that if you're her, right? She's still alive. So you have to be like, oh yeah, here we are. And now, you know, not only can people sit where they want to on a bus, but this man might be president. So we can't talk to her because she'll never talk about it. In 80 years, she's not talked about it. No, I'm sorry. There was a book written recently where she did actually talk about the fact that that was not what was meant to happen. So we did a lot of research on Carolyn Bryant. She was married to Roy Bryant, who was one of the, James Milam and Roy Bryant were the two men who were brought up on murder charges and were acquitted. And then and then confessed to the murder in Look magazine a year later. You learn some things, though, and this is what our piece is about. It's a small town. I mean, it's about, you know, the size of this room, really, in terms of the number of people. And you learn things like Roy says to Emmett Till's Uncle Moses, you know, it wasn't me, it was J.W. on the steps of the courthouse. He says, it wasn't me. Shame? Why is he ashamed if he's, you know, a monster? He is a monster who's ashamed because when they pick the boy up, that he says to Moses, we're not going to kill him, we're just going to scare him a little. And Moses has to relent, right? Because otherwise, you know, he's dead the next day. So you have to make room for that and trust. These are people who knew each other. They borrowed sugar from each other. You know, they birthed each other's babies. They were neighbors. They knew each other, right? That's a different level of crime. And then you find out she didn't want to tell her husband. He heard from a rumor that this kid had sassed his wife. And now what does he have to do? Well, male behavior is also codified. And white male behavior is also codified. So now he's got to stand up in a way. He's got to do something about it, right? What does it mean to have participated in that? You still have to deal with yourself. So we're just like trying to figure out like moments of fantasy. I bought the transcript for the trial. And it's theater, you know, we didn't have to write the script. We just took the words right out of the page. you know, the description of what happened, and we started asking questions about what does that mean? What does it mean to put your hand out? And how did you grab her behind the counter if that's what they said he did? We know he didn't do any of the things that they said, right? That's all fabricated, right? And it's easy. But we are a country that still allows for the fabrication to be foremost in our mind. And we are convinced later on that people are human and they didn't deserve to have to go through that. But in the moment, you know, there's a lot of fear. So the piece is an experimental piece because that's my true aesthetic is experimental. And we're just trying to figure out what happened in those fateful moments. You know, we do repeat the cycle of all the things that they describe, and then we ask questions in the movement. Here's how we scripted it, because neither one of us are playwrights. We'd pull out something, an article or something related, we'd get an idea from it, and then Andrea would start improvising. And I'd be like, great, a little bit more of that, less of that. And then she'd improv a little bit more. Okay, some of this, some of that, great. And then we got the other person who played Emmett Till, and they started improvising. And then we'd write it down. Hurry up, wait, hold it, let's write this down. We scripted it off the body, as opposed to sitting in dark rooms, sort of, you know, genius closet again. None of that happened. It was really about how can we draw from this. As a black woman, I was raised in Oakland, California. My parents were revolutionaries in the 60s. They fought for civil rights. You know, she's a white woman. She grew up in Lafayette, Louisiana. Her parents were activists in some way or another, but what is the intersection between us and that work? And how do we find where we live in those spaces? It took 8 years to create that piece. 8 years. That's the beauty of having a little teeny theater company that you could just do whatever you want and take your time to gestate on those ideas. One of the things I'll say about this is Andrea kept saying, just remember, there are ghosts here. Just remember, there are ghosts. So we kept that in the forefront. Not that we wouldn't disturb the ghosts, but that if we're going to disturb those ghosts, we better be prepared. Because we're walking into, you know, sanctified space here. That boy died, and a lot happened because of it after, but the way he died still lives in the work. It still lives in what we're doing, and it still lives in us right now, today. Last thing I'll say, right around the same time like we did our third workshop, Tamir Rice was shot and killed by a cop within like 3 seconds of the cop's arrival. Police opens the door, shoots this child. There's a justification for it because he looked like an adult or all these. And if you read over those transcripts, you'll have the same moment of like, how did you come up with this? Where do those ideas come from? Why do you hold that? You know, he was a kid playing in a park, which is where you should be able to play and not get killed by law enforcement. So it still happens, you know, those moments still happen.